Some of you have been here for most of the sessions and saw the video, the first on Monday, or Tuesday, I guess it was. But others of you I know are new to this is your first session, so I think it'll still make sense. But we do have a history building up to this point. We have, I guess on Wednesday, we focus more on the global issue of peacemaking and what individual Christians and congregations can do. Yesterday, we looked more at the community level. What do we do to build peace in our own communities, our cities, our towns, our neighborhoods? And we did a role play about a church council facing the issue of gang violence in their own community, and how could the church respond? So that's some of what we've done this week. And that video, Green Shoots of Peace, which we saw the first day, really looks at peacemaking in a very broad way, that it's not just peace between nations, but that it's peacemaking is what we do in our churches, in our families, in our communities, as well as on a global level. So what I'd like to start out with, we haven't done much biblical work this week, but I'd like for us to start this morning by looking at a few selected verses in the New Testament related to our calling to be peacemakers. And then we'll look some, for those of you who are Lutherans, we're going to look some at the Lutheran liturgy, and this is, if others of you are from different traditions, a lot of the same words and so on are probably in the services of your denominations. But let's start by looking up, luckily a lot of these verses are close to each other, Ephesians, the second chapter, the 14th verse. Yeah, that's
what
you need a Bible.
Yeah, that's so.
Most of you will have RSV. Okay. Is there someone that could read that? Ephesians 2:14.
For you. For he is our peace. In his flesh, he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility between us.
So Jesus is our peace. Turn to the, somebody's still looking at me. We're going too fast. Ephesians, it's after Galatians, between Galatians and Philippians.
But you switch.
Everybody got it?
Yeah.
Sue, why don't you reread that? That's 2:14. It's short.
For he is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall that is the hostility between us.
Okay. It's interesting. In this case, of course, the he is Jesus. And that the church, of course, at that time was both Jew and Gentile. And I think that what this is referring to here is having broken down the wall of hostility between those two communities. But it's still also a broader image of how in the church we are diverse, but we are one, and out of that oneness, that is part of where our mission for peacemaking comes. Let's now turn to chapter 4 of Ephesians, and verses 1-3. Would somebody read that?
I therefore, a prisoner of the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all lowliness and meekness, with patience, forbearing one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Did you say 2:4?
Yes.
There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call.
Okay. All right, and about Galatians, which is back one, Galatians 5:22-23. Somebody read that?
Galatians 5:21.
But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law.
Okay. So So peace is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness. This is Paul writing here in Galatians. Okay, now the last one is one we read in other classes, so we'll read it again. 2 Corinthians, again, back one book here. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 19. Someone read that?
That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation.
Okay, that to me is one of the most powerful statements of this basic idea that peace is God's gift to us and is also our task. And that, in fact, is the title of the study document on peace, which the Lutherans are going to be coming out with, the ELCA. Welcome. It will be out and available by the end of September. And it's a study document to enable all congregations to participate in the study of peace and to help shape the new ELCA social statement on peace that will be coming out. There'll be a first draft next year and then a second draft the following year that will be voted on at the churchwide assembly. But the title of the study document is Peace, God's Gift Our Task. And this is in Lutheran theology and ethics. Sort of what we call this is a central move. I mean, this is how we understand basically Christian vocation and life in the world, that we are first, you know, gifted by God and blessed by God, chosen by God through our baptism, and therefore we go out and do what God has called us to do. And these verses that we just read, I think, make that connection between the peace that God has given us through Jesus Christ and our calling to be peacemakers in the world. And a famous phrase in Lutheran ethics is, not only Lutheran ethics, it's you know, used in other denominations also, is faith, active, and love. And the phrase we're using in our study document is faith, active, for peace. So one of the reasons this is so important, I think, and I appreciate any reactions you have to it, is that, and this is why our task force is going to really try to, you know, it's going to begin biblically and theologically and then move to what it is that we're called to do. It's one of the reasons I think this is really important is that I think so often an issue like peace is marginalized and is put out on the fringe of, you know, what it means to be the church or to be a Christian. And it's sort of what these maverick people do, you know. It's not like central to what it means to be the church. And what we're asserting here is that, in fact, it is central. It's at the heart of biblical testimony. It's at the heart of our worship, and we'll look at that in a minute. And we're not just talking about a peace that that is in the world to come, but we're talking about peace now, peace in our lives today. So I think we're trying to carve out some center ground for this issue in the life of the church, and that maybe in your congregation it is seen that way, but I think in a lot of congregations it isn't. It's still seen as something, you know, out here, you know, what we do on Sunday, and you know, this has not much to do with peace in the world, but this notion is challenging that and basing it on, you know, just not only these verses, but there are many others. Okay, Anne, you can say something? Anybody have any comments about that? Any reactions to these verses or to this idea that peace is the peace that is a gift from God is what really calls us to be peacemakers in the world? Is that a new idea, or is that something that most people believe here? And is that...
I think I should share what happened last year, just show you, even though we sort of maybe say it. I was just telling Carol that we have adult farms, and they're very well attended in our church. 150 people will go to our adult farm usually. So it's become, from just being church and society's bailiwick, it's become something that people want that time period. So a year ago this summer, they were setting up the forums for the next year, and the Constitution had changed, so one committee got authority over them. And when the schedule came out, this is right after the Gulf War, when the schedule came out, Church and Society had put two, had done their forums, I think they had like eight during the year or something, and two were crossed out. And one was on homosexuality and the other was on peacemaking. That committee didn't want the forum on peacemaking. And I think that placement right after the Gulf War had a lot to do with it, and the fact that that committee had raised some issues about the ethicalness of the Gulf War probably made it more controversial. But they had not expected to do a big reprise of the Gulf War. But it's interesting. It shows that we aren't necessarily, when it comes down to the particulars, always comfortable with peacemaking being something even discussed.
Right.
I think sometimes when we get into the issues of peacemaking, it sometimes involves criticism of what our government has been doing. And so people back away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be done in a sensitive, loving way.
Right.
And somehow or other, if we disagree with what our government is doing in our name, we need to let them know we disagree, just to get grumble and get angry and what have you at home doesn't do anything to change things. So to write letters or to participate in some way is helpful, I think. But it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people.
I think people's experience of peace issues in churches, and I think this especially is true for people that are at least, 40 and older, is that, there was a lot of controversy, I think, in at least a fair number of Lutheran churches over the Vietnam War. Maybe to a lesser degree around the Gulf War, but that was a much shorter thing, mm-hmm. So that the Vietnam period was really, I think it was just the opposite of peace, in a sense. It was a peace issue, but people's experience of it in congregations mm-hmm. was this was the most polarizing and divisive and anger-producing kind of thing. And I think that blame for that can go all the way around. It was not just the people who were for the war. It was also mm-hmm. people that were for peace. That because of the anger and passion of their convictions, sometimes I think. Put myself in that category. It went off the deep end. But I think if we look at this in a broad way, that peace building is something that you do on every level, including within your churches, then one's approach to these issues might be very different than the kind of, which is not letting go of the, of truth, but, truth with love is, mm-hmm. I think the... Well, what I'd like to do now is look a little bit, and we have a few LBWs here. How many of you here are Lutherans?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so about
He was.
The liturgies, many of our churches are pretty similar. Let's get right here a little bit. Let's look at, turn to page, let me just take the first setting. Turn to page 56. And first of all, the word peace appears quite a bit in our liturgy. I think that goes, a lot of people, when you use, I've said this a couple other times here, that when we use that word in the liturgy, I don't think people think of peace in the world that much. I mean, it's sort of like a religious term that it doesn't necessarily body, you know, absence of conflict or justice or reconciliation. It's sort of a, you know, word up here, a religious word. But peace is not only, I think, in our worship, in where specifically the word peace is used, it permeates the whole liturgy. I think it begins when we start with brief order for confession and forgiveness, and the words of absolution are pronounced to us. It is peace that God is is making peace with us, that it is God's peace that is offered to us through Jesus. And when we are forgiven, we are at peace with God. And so then when we begin, with the Kyrie in page 57, we begin, in peace, let us pray to the Lord. Well, what in peace means is, you know, we have been given peace. You know, we are already in the state of peace with God because we are baptized believers, and we are at peace with God, which doesn't mean in a sense of that there's never that back and forth, you know, alienation, reconciliation, and stuff. But that, I mean, Luther said baptism is renewed every day. It's not like a once and for all event. We're not just saved once yet. Fundamentally, the event of Christ's death and resurrection has put us in a relationship of peace with God. So we start out in peace. Let us pray to the Lord. And then we go to for peace. And so we're moving from, okay, it's fundamentally we have this. But we continue to be in need of it, for peace from above and for our salvation. So though we have been baptized, we have each day, we need to renew that. And we need to renew our asking for forgiveness and for salvation. And then we go on, you know, okay, not only peace for ourselves, peace in our relationship with God, the vertical peace, but now we're going into for the peace of the whole world. So it's from the up and down dimension to the outward dimension, you know, all this in our opening Kyrie, and for the unity of all. So we begin our worship with, you know, fundamental affirmation of both the gift of peace and the calling and wanting peace for the world. And then we go on, glory to God in the highest. We do that particular hymn of praise. That ends up it starts out, glory to God in the highest, and peace to God's people on earth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, not just a peace with God, but peace among peoples. And then we go... we go from there into the lessons, and then if you go over to page 65, in our prayers, lots of times we will pray for the peace of the world, and I'm sure that a lot of you will have prayers, you know, in your prayers for specific situations, whether for the Middle East or Yugoslavia or for you know, Central America, South Africa, whatever. And then we share the peace after the prayers. Let me just read something here. This is from one of the drafts of the social statement, that the peace of the Lord be with you always is a common greeting in the Middle East from biblical times. Probably know that the Hebrew word for hello and goodbye is what? Shalom. So when you go to Israel, it's shalom, yeah. Shalom. But in the Arab countries, the most common greeting that you will hear is salam alaikum, which you can also hear in Muslim communities here. Salam is peace in Arabic. Shalom in Hebrew and salam, they're very related. So salam alaikum, peace be with you. And that's one of the commonest greetings since ancient times. So we greet one another with the gift of peace that we already have from God, but also with the intent of making peace in our community. And that we do that before we come to the Lord's table. And then we go into the Holy Supper. And at that point, again, I'd like to read a little bit from the statement that The bread broken and the wine poured out reminds us of God's way of bringing peace by the power of sacrificial love. And the sharing of the meal, all who participate receive the bread and wine, all have enough, all share, and no one hoards. And the meal sharing becomes a sign of God's justice and God's vision of a world of abundant bread for all. So that it models, in a way, the sharing that is necessary for real peace. And we've talked so much about that connection between peace and justice, that part of the cause of war and of conflict and the lack of peace is, you know, unequal distribution of resources, and that people do not have the, you know, what they need to live. Then we go into when we Lord, now let your servant go in peace. One of the what we call the Nunc Dimittis in the old liturgy. This is page 73. Our church, we usually sing "Thank the Lord" and sing His praise. But in Lent and at other more somber liturgical times, we'll sing, "Lord, now let your servant go in peace. Your word has been fulfilled." And of course, Lamb of God, too, just before that, the last phrase, "Lamb of God, take away the sin of the world and grant us peace." And then of course, how do we end our liturgy? You know, every Vespers here, and you know, it's go in peace, serve the Lord. Which again connects, I think, this twofold movement of, you know, go in peace. You know, God has made peace with us and gives us the peace, unites us, and then we go forth in service. So I think, you know, to me, this understanding of the liturgy, which of course is you can't get more to the heart of the church than that in most people's minds, I think helps us who are committed to peace in the church. I find this as a bridge I've seen this in the more people, you know, peace is not really their concern, and I think sometimes by starting with our worship and with our baptism and some of these basic verses in the Bible, we can help people see how this is central to who we are rather than a marginal kind of thing. And I think also it can help us diffuse some of the tensions that so often arise around this issue. So, people, you know, any reactions to that? Have you been aware of these things in the liturgy in this way? I mean, or is this sort of a new thing? I mean, is this a...
I never realized that peace was so central in the liturgy.
I didn't realize it quite as much, you know.
It's interesting. I think our the study document that we're doing is going to end up with really focusing on worship on the last chapter. The study document is going to have 7 chapters. It's too long, but we can help ourselves. But it flows. It begins with God. Goes from God to the God of peace, to faith active for peace, and then goes into, in the middle, sort of the political issues of peace today. How we order power, how we build security, how we do justice, and then it comes back to the church as a community of peace, and then finally to our praise of the God of peace in worship. So that's how this thing's going to flow, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes, because I think historically in our churches we've looked at peace much more a sort of a political issue and not widened it out to see. Sue?
Does it begin with a definition? I mean, it's one thing if you think of peace as the absence of war.
Yeah.
Or if you think of peace in the broader spectrum, which includes justice.
It's gonna have definitions at various points, although not necessarily right at the beginning, but yeah.
Because I think most people think of peace the absence of war. So if we're not actively at war, we are at peace.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look around the community and say,
I think that's important, and hopefully, I mean, the study document is not a perfect thing. I've just read the final draft, and it's going to the printer in about a week, and it's a lot of good stuff in there, but we still it's hard for the church to, you know, if these things are written in committees, you have one writer finally, but it's, you know, but I think there's a lot of opportunity too for people who study this document this fall to give input to what could help, you know, clarify this. Mm-hmm.
So if we send for the document as indicated on the board, we will get this preliminary draft.
You will get what's called the study document, which is preliminary to, it's not a preliminary study document, it's preliminary to writing the social statements. In the way, I talked about this last week, that the way that ELCA now is doing its social statements by and large is it's taking a long, I mean, a fairly long process to do what they call major teaching statements. It's usually about a 3-year process. We already have one on death penalty and abortion. This summer they're approving or going to consider one on race and ethnicity and culture, and one on environment. And then in 95, the peace statement will be up and the human sexuality statement. But the human sexuality statement has been percolating already for several years. But the idea is to get as many people involved in discussing this. And so first what comes out from each task force is a study document, which raises issues, you know, doesn't so much try to make a, you know, stand for the church, but like tries to be a discussion document. And then people give feedback, and then a draft social statement, which is much shorter, mm-hmm. you know, and more compact is written, and that will be next year. But the ordering information for the study document is up on the kiosk if anybody wants to write down the number of it. And they discourage us from, I guess I could have made copies of this thing, but they try to not have us make too many copies here, so we're being too much paper. Okay, what I'd like to do for a few minutes then is talk about the church as a community for peace, and then I want to come to you know, where our church, we have a little questionnaire that came along with the video actually about where our church is strong and weak on the business of peacemaking, on peace building. But before we do that, the study document talks about the church as a community of peace in three different ways. That sometimes the church is as a community for peace, may be a disturbing presence in society. And this gets back to when we're talking about some of the difficulties of talking about these issues in our churches, is that you know, sometimes the truth needs to be told and people don't want to hear it, and then how do we do that in a way in love? But the church has a disturbing presence. What would you give any examples? Could you give any examples of when you think the church, either like your congregation or you know, wider church bodies, have been a disturbing presence for peace? What would be an example of that?
When a congregation speaks out against a war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's obvious. Right. Like the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah.
Or goes to marches. You know, big group mm-hmm. of people going.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was that story about bishops of, I think it was the Anglican and Lutheran and some of the mainstream bodies going to speak to Bush mm-hmm. before the Gulf War.
Right.
And I think the last statement that Bush made was feeling bad that he was going to be going against what his bishop uh-huh. told him. I can't remember.
Right, Browning. Yeah.
I don't know what the exact quote, but that was a real direct, disturbing uh-huh. statement of the church directly to uh-huh. a person making the decision.
Right. And sometimes you would say, like, you know, marching and you know, witnessing in that way, I think a lot of times on social issues, and, you know, maybe not a lot of times, but certainly during the civil rights era, during the Vietnam era, and on the nuclear weapons question, certain times church leaders have, and lay people, clergy and lay people have, you know, done things that have been, you know, a public witness, sometimes, you know, getting arrested or, you know, like there's a pastor in Seattle, John Nelson, who has, you know, I think would be a good example of someone who's been a disturbing presence, although also, how many of you know who this person is?
Yeah. His mother, too. Who's
he's been written a number of times, Lutheran. He's now pastor, he used to be pastor at the University of Washington. And in fact, I was just out of college when he was hired. I was on the personnel committee that hired him. That was right across out of school. But then he's been at Capitol, Central is not Capitol Hill. But he has protested, you know, the Trident submarine for a long time, and then he protested also the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Spent time in jail, but also a really loving person. Really warm-hearted, friendly, you know, not at all sort of a dour kind of image of somebody who's, you know, feels like they're so pure, and, you know, he's not that kind of person at all, yeah.
I think sometimes that sort of presence really serves. I always think of it as the prophetic voice.
Right.
You know, in our community, there's a Catholic workers community that runs three homes for the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, the couple that started it, who have two young children, she regularly goes to what's called ELF sites in Wisconsin.
Oh, right. That's the
The electromagnetic.
It has something to do with ABMs.
Yes.
Yeah, I think.
And they have a traditional Mother's Day presence there, and she goes to jail probably mm-hmm. 3-4 times a year. And you sometimes wonder, well, you know. But I think she just feels that is a reminder. And mm-hmm. I think to the rest of us who don't necessarily take that mm-hmm. prophetic stand, that there still is a problem with the use of resources for war machinery and mm-hmm. what it may even do environmentally.
Mm-hmm. And when we think of ourselves as a body, you know, with many parts and many gifts, then I think, you know, we can look at these different roles and say, as a whole church, we need to fulfill all of these things, but some of us are called more to do one thing mm-hmm. than another. And I think that's okay.
It's interesting, in the church in Seattle where John Nelson is pastor, I think he's the assistant now, because it was a struggle for them to know how to deal with it. Do they pay his salary when he's in jail? Mm-hmm. And if they don't pay his salary, how does his family eat? Mm-hmm. And so Lutheran Peace Fellowship there's a fund, I believe, through Lutheran mm-hmm. Peace Fellowship that does pay his salary when he's in jail, so the congregation doesn't have to
mm-hmm.
to carry Jesus. But because I'm sure, like in any congregation, some people think he's doing a wonderful thing, and to some people he's a real embarrassment.
Yeah.
But it's
mm-hmm. it's interesting to watch, even in this Catholic worker community, which is a very radical community, and the decisions they've made as far as their life. I think there's like 11 to 14 members who run these three homes and live right in the homes where people are homeless. But she can get out. She can have that. They don't put pressure, even within that community, on who should choose to be arrested mm-hmm. or who should go to the ELF site. So they acknowledge, even in that small community, which by definition is sort of taking some radical stance, that each time they go out, mm-hmm. it's an individual decision if they want to mm-hmm. take the most prophetic sort of mm-hmm. role.
Right. Well, the second sort of kind of presence that a community of peace is called to be is a reconciling presence. And of course, sometimes, you know, a disturbing presence and a reconciling presence could be in tension with one another, you know. And, you know, how we live in that tension at different times, you know, see different emphasis is needed, you know, that can be a struggle for, you know, for an individual, for a church. But that's also really important, and in certain conflicts, you know, that may be the primary thing the church does, you know, when things are really polarized, and there are many truth speakers, you know, that the church may need to be a bridge between communities. Can you think of any examples of this?
Well, perhaps the church in there, through Augsburg, when they go to Central America,
mm-hmm.
what you read in the newspaper is true, but it's not always the whole truth. And so by having people go under the auspices of the church through groups mm-hmm. and to see more of the whole truth, and then to come back and speak to people in congregations.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was attempted in the, and I don't know enough about, I haven't read the statement and haven't heard enough discussion, but what was attempted in the abortion statement, social statement, where the church, I think, tried to listen to both sides and tried to find a path that would acknowledge the validity of both sides. I know within our church, a small group with people from both sides studied that and were able to kind of heal some wounds between themselves in some ways in just getting to know each other's point of view and studying.
That's right. The same thing happened in our church. We had, not that there were wounds because people hadn't really discussed it before, but we had pro-choice and pro-life people on in the small group and they could hear each other. I think, you know, also like the whole business of trying to overcome stereotypes and the whole educational process of I was like, because my I have one about that size, and also has to leap up to like through the windows, same height. Yesterday the poor guy, he didn't, you know, he missed his 11:45 lunch because Ron thought I had him, and I thought Ron had him, and so the guy was anyway. But I think also that the building bridges count, you know, part of that is countering stereotypes. And one of the examples they bring up here in the study document is, like, for example, the whole issue now, and this relates to my husband's class on Muslims and Christians and Jews, but there's so many stereotypes right now about Muslims. And, you know, you think, I just looked at the paper yesterday about the indictment of this sheikh in, you know, Jersey City, and it just, you know, all that fueled so much, you know, anti-Muslim stereotype in this country. And I think that the churches have a lot, you know, to do to educate themselves and then to help. You know, this is not, you know, this is not the norm in the Muslim world. You know, this is not, you know, your average Muslim is not this sheikh from Jersey City. And I think that's part of the task of reconciliation.
They're not all carrying bombs in their back pocket.
Right, exactly, right. No, I mean, it's, you know, it's really hard when you know Muslims that are peace-loving and, you know, how painful this is for them. Oh, you know, this is, and they have so little power in society by and large. I mean, they're not very well organized and, you know, who follows the Arabic press in this country. I mean, it's just, you know, it's really like sort of, you know, really dismayed.
And when you hear some of these stereotypes, you realize that, you know, it's blown way out of proportion. Yet some of it sticks in your mind. And I know we were in Israel last December and we went to visit Father Shakur, this little Arab village. We had just read a warning letter to one of the people in our group. She has a cousin who lives in Israel. And he would not come. He's married to a Jewish woman, and he would not come to where we were staying because it was in the Arab quarter, and he had like a three-page letter explaining in great detail the terrible dangers to do anything in the Arab world. I mean, you take your life in your hands. Yeah. And here we are going on a public bus to an Arab village, and part of me knew that everything would be fine, but still in the back of my mind I'm thinking, you know, will we ever come back?
Yeah, right.
We were over there about 10 years ago, and of course it was different then, except for the dog height. That was still a little. But we went at the right time, I guess.
Well, this, I mean, it was dangerous about 10 years ago, too, though, because that was, after the Gulf War. Right. I mean, the Gulf War after the war in Lebanon.
But we were as a group, so.
Yeah. Well, the third kind of presence that we are called to be is a serving presence. So the first is disturbing, reconciling, and serving. And that takes many forms, but what we've seen is that, you know, to build peace, you know, a lot of times what is needed is really, you know, service. And when we looked at the case like of El Salvador, with the church, through a lot of its projects and through also advocating, you know, human rights, you know, support for human rights in El Salvador, you know, advocating a cutting military aid, all those things that were ways of serving the cause of justice and those people in El Salvador. and were things that the church has been involved in. Also helping refugees, which is, you know, all these things are part of building peace. Any comments about those three different kinds of presence for peacemaking?
Well, I'm not sure what I missed exactly, but Unitarian Church that I go to, peace is a really big focus. Uh-huh. And not just, I mean, there are forums before services often,
uh-huh.
you know, information about what's going on in Yugoslavia uh-huh. or some other place. During the coffee hour, there's almost always someone uh-huh. with a petition
right.
or something to send to
right.
a congressman. But on a different level, like with the kids, there's something called Children Teaching Children
mm-hmm.
that the kids from our church and from a temple and from a mosque and a black church all get together
mm-hmm.
on a weekend and
mm-hmm.
teach each other
right.
for understanding.
Right.
And then their projects, there was something called Eyes on the Prize, showing
yes.
movies
yeah.
to do with the black.
Right,
yeah, I mean, just a lot of trying to get understanding.
Yeah, build bridges. Yeah, that
yeah.
the second part was a reconciling presence, and that would be part of that. I mean, I think, you know, building bridges of understanding, you know, trying
really
to
important.
Deal with stereotypes
yeah.
and all of that is really important. And we've hardly touched on, and one thing that I'm really interested in now, and I've hardly touched on in these 2 weeks here, was teaching peace to children. And this has become a more and more big, you know, I mean, it really is starting to make inroads into our church, and I think we have a long way to go on it, but I think this is where we really have a huge task. There's a booklet out now. This is not for young children. There's actually quite a lot of good material on, and there's quite a few things here in this bookstore, but there's a lot of good material on this, and, you know, those churches that have, like, you know, preschools and kindergartens, of course, Sunday school, and there's a lot of stuff that you can do with kids, and more people are becoming trained on this and how to, you know, train teachers to deal with this. But for the older kids, there's a new resource put out by the Presbyterians and the Lutherans called Youth and Peacemaking, and what's neat about it is it's, again, multidimensional, and it's about peace in our relationships and families and so on, and peace in our schools, responding to bullies, you know, from the level of, you know, so your personal life to the more global community. And I'll leave this out here for anybody. Actually, I have extra copies of this if anybody wants to buy one. I've got a couple of them. It's really good. It's got a lot of fun exercises too, like games and, you know, like not teaching through lecture, but getting kids to, in fact, most of it is participatory.
Yes, that would do more good to
yeah,
work with
yeah.
the young ones.
Yeah.
Than the old ones.
What I'd like to do now is just, we really probably don't have enough time to really do this, but we'll take a shot at it. And, could be an hour and a half here. The point of us actually being able to.
Are there any extra pens or pencils?
I might have a pencil in my pocket. Oh, I did have one in my pocket.
I have a pen that someone could use for that hand that he's placing on. Erase. This is
The video that I showed on Monday or Tuesday, Green Shoots of Peace, had a study guide with it, and it's available through the Lutheran Synods. But the study guide is designed to help congregations to work through this issue. This was done, of course, before the study document comes out. But it's in a way, if you have a shorter amount of time to work on this issue, that this this half hour video can be a vehicle for sort of like a one-shot thing. But this is a self-assessment questionnaire for congregations in where they are at on the various kinds of peacemaking that are talked about in this video. And I thought we might just go through it briefly to, quickly, as a group and sort of raise hands and so forth to see where we're at as a church. And I think if you did all these things, I mean, there would be no church on earth that would do all these things. But let's just go quickly through it and see what I'll ask you is just, do any of your churches do these things? And so just to get the yes tally, because I think probably there won't be that many yeses. Peace with the earth. My congregation has made at least one visible, public and visible commitment to caring for the earth, for example, using china instead of disposable cups. Has any of your churches done that?
Yes.
Okay. 5 of you. Good. Congregation uses recycled paper in its bulletins, newsletters, and other publications.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Church building is as energy efficient as possible.
I'd say they're frugal in the use of fuel because it's pretty cold.
Okay. Congregation conserves water through the use of low flow faucets and landscaping that reduces need for water.
We have landscaping.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Members of my congregation are simplifying their lifestyles. For example, recycling or whatever. How many of you would say? Yeah.
And we have a center at church. You can bring the recycled stuff, and a couple of people will cart it to where it needs to go.
My congregation facilitates citizen activity on behalf of the environment. For example, legislative advocacy, public service, or education of the larger community. Any of you? As citizens. Okay, peace with the poor. And we're just going through this quickly here. And you can take these home with you. Preaching and prayers, my congregation has expressed its concern for the millions of Central American people trapped by poverty and violence, especially those in El Salvador. Say in general terms,
Our pastor went to El Salvador.
My congregation has educated its members on the causes of poverty, I would say, not just in Mexico, but in the Southern Hemisphere. How many of your congregations have, had any programs or awareness building about poverty in the third world?
Our granddaughter's gone down there.
Not well attended, though. I mean, they're there, but the same 6-8 people.
Excuse me. Where is your church? You're
Edmonds Unitarian.
Edmonds Unitarian. Okay. Through preaching and prayers, my congregation fully supported the struggle for Namibia's independence. This would be a more Lutheran kind of thing, because Lutherans are to Namibia, but and continues to make the deepening poverty in Southern Africa a mission challenge. How many? One. Okay.
One thing that really helps, I think, is our pastor went to Central America, and then Beth and I were just part of an 8-member contingent that just were in Namibia 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Just got back. And somehow, we talked about the number of people who are involved, Sue. Mm-hmm. I think the pastor going.
Our pastor has gone to Central America, but he has given 2 programs, but it was at the Methodist Church. Family involved in Nicaragua also. Yeah. And the woman has gone and given programs in many churches, but no, she has not been asked to. I mean, it's really kind of strange.
Because her
husband was on the Electro project where that Ben Linder was killed, and her husband replaced him.
Uh-huh. Right.
And it was
prophets are without honor in your hometown, right?
That is interesting, because now I think that if I had just gone, I went to the same Central American trip as our pastor, and if I had come back and done a program, it wouldn't have been nearly as well attended as it was.
Yeah.
He and I both.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, my congregation has educated its members on the need to back the creation of democratic, multiracial, and economically just societies throughout Southern Africa. Well, that's sort of similar to... Okay, and this is, will be related to Lutherans too. My congregation actively supports my synod's companion synod program, which enables members of our church to establish significant relations with Christians in other nations of the world. How many of you who are Lutherans know about the companion synod program?
I'm not sure.
You know, we did some talking during this trip to Namibia because it's we were talking about the problem that large churches are having in the things that the bigger church does that don't impact the grassroots, the home congregation. And I know our pastor feels that there's some advantages of congregation to congregation or people to people contacts because they're much more real to people and they will get behind them where the synod, I don't even know, I know there's a synod to synod program, but because we've gotten involved on this, we have a sister congregation in Russia,
yeah.
And we have a sister congregation in Namibia, both of which members of our church have visited several times. That is real alive, and we never have any trouble raising money for those particular places.
Yeah, we have somebody from there come to our church. That's been a while ago.
Well, that's something, so, you know, I mean, I would say that in that, when that would include sister-to-sister kind of things, too. But, what about number six? My congregation alleviates poverty in the United States by meeting its local, synod, and church-wide benevolence goals.
Yes,
and or sustaining its own members in times of economic hardship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one that's been important.
Okay.
Did that include money to...
It wasn't at one time, but it is.
What about your receiving? You mean you can.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Like hunger centers? Is
right. Well, or, you know, like if you're, you know, your contribution, the Lutheran Church would be our contribution to the Synod and to the World Hunger Appeal. Does your church do that too? Yeah. Okay.
That's fine.
So and we're involved to some extent in Bread for the World also. Mm-hmm. We're not a covenant church.
How many of you have congregations, number seven here, that share resources, either space, food, clothing, funds with the poor in our community?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Always.
Everybody probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would guess that's probably the most common.
We're housing the homeless right now in our church at night. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We are.
And for us, we voted for a 6-month, it was rather interesting, there was quite a bit of opposition at first. By some of the neighbors who belonged to the church. They thought they'd be wandering down into their yards. And so we voted to try it for 6 months and instead of, and had the whole congregation vote on it after 6 months. So that's what came out of it.
It's a trial run.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the 6 months isn't up yet, but it's working fine so far.
Uh-huh.
We have a homeless shelter, and people in our congregation serve as volunteers, our pastor and quite a few others. But it has been very interesting in the framework of setting it up. They had some guidelines. It was for families or for mothers with children or fathers with children, but no single adults. I think it was no single men. And so that eliminated a whole bunch of people. And I think there were many nights that there wasn't anyone. Mm-hmm. There, the volunteers sat there, and no one had come by 10 o'clock, they left. But
this is a good program. They police themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone gets out of line, they're put on the bus and sent back downtown.
Right.
Yeah. So it's working.
So that's a city. See, we're a small town, 7,000.
Okay, number eight. Members of my congregation are urged to be advocates for humane and just public policy at local, state, and national levels. In other words, that would be. You know, people are encouraged to write to their congressperson or their state senator or whatever. How many of you would have your churches involved in that? Okay.
Bread for the World is a good kind of way to open the door on that if you're interested.
Right.
Because I think it's kind of less controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And once people kind of get used to the fact that there will be a gathering of letters once in a while for hunger issues, it kind of opens the door a little bit. It's all right to be activist.
Right.
We had our children get involved in that in our summer Sunday school. an adult wrote the letter, because we had 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, mm-hmm. and that would be a holiday project, and then the kids all wrote their names on mm-hmm. these letters, and so.
Peace with the enemy. How many of your churches observe the week for Christian unity during January or part of ecumenical services?
Well, just once through the year.
What about your church, Sue?
Not on a regular basis, but I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about your church? No. My congregation has established relations with people of other faiths through interfaith dialogues, events, and travel.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now, I don't think we are. We went through a lot of years where we did. Right now.
How many of your churches prayed for the Iraqis during the Gulf War?
There was a prayer in Sojourners, I think, for the Iraqis, and mm-hmm. it seems to me that was circulated mm-hmm. in the congregation. And I guess I'm not sure.
That's interesting. Okay.
There's some on the back.
I know, there's one in the back. We're going to get through all this. Let's see, we'll pick and choose. The next one, my congregation has made concrete attempts to overcome racial and ethnic prejudice. There's some examples there. How many of you would say yes to that?
I would say yes.
Uh-huh.
We have very few ethnic minorities in our
We've got a lot more than ever were, and it's not easy for them, I think.
Yes.
But they have their own church, so they're welcome.
Okay. Let's skip down to peace in the church quickly. Number one, the leadership of my congregation know how to make space for different points of view. Minority positions are given equal time, and all members are respected. How many would you say yes? Okay, that's good. How many of you were able to have discussions of the Gulf War in your congregation?
I don't think we had a lot of discussion of it.
We did some, and you did, Anne?
Yeah, but it was kind of after. I mentioned to Carol, too, that after there was a negotiation between these two committees, one which was trying to censor the other. A couple families left the church once a system was set up where one wasn't going to censor the book. Mm-hmm. So a couple families did not feel it was okay for some reasons
to be. I guess if you bring it down to individuals in our congregation discussed it, but we didn't have a forum or a formalized thing. So if you look at individuals,
How many, putting sort of 3 and 4 together, how many of you, and I don't know about Unitarians, do they have social statements that come out from your...
There are some, yeah.
How many of you have had discussions of any of the churches, your church's social statements? Just one.
There have been some. I haven't been actually been involved in
that. But there have been in your church. Yeah, okay.
We have tried, after coming to Holden and discussing some of these issues here, have tried to start something at home, and it's met with anger. I guess, that's none of our business. We should stay out of that. Like the human sexuality issue. No way. You get red faces and just terribly upset. And so, we have not pursued.
I don't know about the secondary, but I guess I would say in the Unitarian Church, it's almost the flip side of the coin. If you take the Gulf War,
Like
everybody's against it.
Right.
If somebody is for it, they're ostracized.
Right.
You're not as there.
Sure.
Right.
And the two sides can talk together with respect and realize that you can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's harder. It's not any better in a way.
It's right. Well, it's the whole idea that that God is on our side, and that whether we're more for peace or war, we sort of get this moral righteousness that makes it hard to have a discussion.
Actually, it would be hard, but not for that reason.
Yeah.
Because I don't think.
Yeah, no. It's, not maybe world righteousness, but God's on our side. that it's the political issue, not the political issue. On the whole, let's look at number six. On the whole, I would regard my congregation as a lively, learning community of believers who can ask hard questions of one another because of their common desire to be faithful. Would any of us say yes to that?
No.
I think that's one of the things that's unique about our church, and why it was so scary when this thing happened. Because there really has developed this sense, kind of coming out of the Vietnam War, when the pastor allowed a draft-resisting group to meet in the church, and the church came to the understanding that didn't mean that everyone in the church had to agree with that, but that it was all right for the church to provide a space for that to happen. And that's where it was scary a year ago, when suddenly one group was trying to censor it.
Right.
And because I think it is hard to keep that going, and it is, I've learned a lot, because I would come from a more Unitarian point of view, and we have some very, very conservative people in our church, and I've learned to respect their Christian commitment, because they may really disagree with me on what should happen about pornography or what should happen about abortion, but I've seen them really act in faith on some other issues, and it's been good learning.
Yeah, well, that's such a wonderful model to uphold, because I think, you know, we have to all get to the place where I work in a pretty, fairly homogenous church. I think in some ways the greatest goal of all would be, and I saw this sort of since I came there, that if we could see diversity as a gift rather than as a threat. Mm-hmm. I mean, this comes down to that, isn't diversity a wonderful gift from God that we can delight in, you know, that we can somehow, I was listening to Wes Preed this morning, and I was thinking, here's Wes, you know, up there, you know, I mean, and he's been coming here all these years, you know, and he gets up there, and it's God, he, and it's traditional, you know, and you know that some of these, you know, college students on staff are probably just like, you know, they would no more, you know, get up there and give their devotions that way than fly, you know, I mean, but isn't it wonderful, you know, that some, I mean, that there's that, you know, and of course that's a struggle at home, is there space for all that diversity, but, you know, that somehow that's just really neat, you know, that Wes Preeb can stand up there and give his thing, and, you know, and then tomorrow it's going to be somebody else, and they're going to talk about our mother God or something, you know, and, you know, okay, you know, and that's, and I think it's, that's part of what peacemaking is all about, to celebrate